If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
A different future starts with you. That's why GoDaddy does more than help you find a name. You can create, sell, and get found online, so any small business could be a driving force to create change or build an empire. We know old ideas aren't cutting it anymore, so we're calling for a new generation of thinking, your way of thinking. So whatever you have in mind that will help make a different future, find everything you need to get started at GoDaddy.com. Because the future isn't decided yet. It's up to us to make it happen. Start different at GoDaddy.com.
This is an ode to the glass noodle. You may be glass only in name, but our love for you is crystal clear in every Bibigo Korean dumpling. Your tantalizing texture tickles the taste buds. And while you are see-through, the world can't help but see you. The glass noodle, one of many obsessively crafted ingredients in every plump and juicy Korean dumpling from Bibigo. Go handcrafted. Go Bibigo. Authentic Korean dumplings now in the freezer aisle.
This is Podco Media Networks.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Hey, Garnett, how's it going?
Great. How's it going on the East Coast?
It's in the upper 30s.
Oh, sorry to hear it.
What's it like out there in paradise?
70 degrees and sunny.
Oh, I'm not envious at all.
No, well, no need to be. No need to be.
We have Brad Barbera, founder and chief enabler of strategic innovation at Pi Innovation, with us. Before we started recording, Garnett, I think you used a great phrase to describe him, and that is an innovation pro.
Sort of self-explanatory, but, you know, why don't we kick it right over to Brad to maybe start off with some background?
I'm honored and touched that you would say that, and I'm somewhat envious of the 70 degrees, too. It's a tough way to start this out with getting deep into envy. But yeah, so I have been a 30-year innovator, innovation pro, I guess, because I do it professionally. Started out just coming out of school, I was a chemical engineer and looking at different jobs I could do, and seemed like it was a choice between working with carcinogens for a chemical company, climbing oil derricks in Siberia, or I had this opportunity to work for Kraft Foods. And I thought, hey, food, yeah, that sounds
a lot better.
Sounds good. I can do that. So I started my professional career as a mayonnaise engineer for Kraft.
Oh my God, I love it.
I know. I'm probably the first mayonnaise engineer you've ever encountered, and probably the last.
Now I'm kicking myself. Now I'm kicking myself because that would have been the ultimate introduction lead-in. I should have used that.
You know that's going to be the name of the episode. It's going to be Mayonnaise Engineer.
Oh, Mayonnaise Engineer.
That's genius.
I probably should have kept my mouth shut because I like Innovation Pro better, but...
Did you get to eat a lot of sandwiches? Did you make ham and cheese sandwiches?
We had to eat so much of that stuff. It's crazy. So my job was to make this stuff at 500 pounds a minute. I mean, it was you're making this stuff so fast. You just sit there and wonder who the heck is eating all this. But
it's like Lucille Ball on the assembly line, right?
Yeah. Good one.
I'll tell you, though, my first assignment was working on creating fat-free mayonnaise and Miracle Whip.
Love it.
And it was new to the world product, never been done before. We had to do all sorts of creative tactics to make something that's normally like 70% fat and make it without any fat in it and still taste good. One day I was in the grocery store and I see this woman shopping down that aisle, and she picked up a jar of the fat-free mayonnaise, read the label, and put it in her cart. And I tell you, I wanted to run up to her and just be like, I did that for you. You wouldn't have that without me. It was just so exhilarating. I was just hooked on innovation from the get-go. And then I've kind of bounced around in a variety of different careers, going in pharmaceutical products and cosmetics and office supplies, ergonomic products, so, just a wide variety of industries, but always focused on understanding the customer, understanding opportunities, collecting insights on what they need, and then trying to fill them as best we can. And now we have the good fortune of being able to teach people how to do that and help guide them through the process so that they can be creative and you get that exhilaration of seeing somebody buy their product.
So I've got to take a break and go make a sandwich. I got hungry talking about all that stuff.
I can't believe fat-free mayonnaise would make you hungry, but, you know, to each his own.
If you're going to play that card, and I've got to do some revelations here because I guess, you know, whatever. I could eat wherever I want to eat or buy whatever I want to buy. My almost 5 days a week, not quite 5 days a week, my lunch of choice is a sandwich of some sort with mayonnaise by and large. And so as I've gotten older, I'm a little bit more interested in products like fat-free mayonnaise or like, you know, veginaise, you know, the kind of vegetable mayonnaise.
Yeah. Well, I love veginaise.
But I am a huge fan of mayonnaise to the point where I go to Asian grocery stores to buy, you know, the extra, extra fatty mayonnaise that you get, like, you know, Kewpie. Is it? I think Kewpie is the brand, right? So don't try to one-up me on the mayonnaise thing, dude, because I'm pretty focused on my mayonnaise.
Yeah, I would never imagine one-upping anybody on mayonnaise.
I personally think it's really unusual and really very much to your credit that you have a hard science background and with that went into innovation. I feel like a lot of people who portray themselves as innovation pros don't actually have a hard science background. And in many cases, don't even have a CPG background. It's all theory. And I love how tangible both your education and your formative experiences were.
Interesting you say that, because that was kind of how the birth of PI Innovation, PI is the name of my organization, that came about because of the theory of a pie-shaped brain. And I don't know if you've heard of T-shaped minds, where like you have a lot of broad knowledge and that's the crossbar of the T, and then in one area you go really deep and you have really deep knowledge. And the pie-shaped person has that broad knowledge going across, shallow, but lots of different topics. And then there's one depth in business. And so I did go on to get my MBA. But then there's also that in-depth technical component. And what that enables the pie-shaped mind to do, although that broad, shallow knowledge allows you to kind of make a lot of different connections and think things differently because you've got all these different perspectives, but then you know how to make things happen from a business standpoint and you know how to make them happen from a technical standpoint. And that's where the innovation comes from. You get that creativity, you get the execution, you get the value. It all kind of comes together. So that's where the name of my company came about, was capture all of that in one spot.
Hey, Mark, what would you consider yourself a pie-shaped intellect or
no, a T-shaped? I think I'm a hyphen shaped.
You care to explain that that visual metaphor? Or?
A little about very little. Oh. I know about.
Well,
very modest. Okay. Very modest.
Yeah, that's falsely.
It's
modest.
It's an interesting concept.
I'm pretty sure I'm a T-shape. It feels like it would be very hard to be truly pie-shaped, but I'm not sure.
There are a few people, and I'm not going to necessarily claim to be one, but there are a few that are what have been termed serial innovators who truly are this combination pie-shaped mind. They're the types of people that they can come through with the billion-dollar concepts and billion-dollar businesses for companies like, you know, Procter & Gamble, for example. You know, just tremendously good at understanding the customer, making connections, understanding how the business world works, and, you know, understanding how the technology works so that they can kind of make it all happen.
Right.
I think they're rare, but it really is something that drives impactful innovation.
I think of, you know, people in the world of advertising, like David Ogilvy. It was probably a T-shaped brain, but he could move that lower part to whatever the customer needed and apply his genius there. So maybe that's a slightly different interpretation, but that's how I see someone like him.
Is the pie-shaped concept, is that a Clayton Christensen concept? Because I know we want to spend some time on that giant of innovation during this call at some point.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know if he was familiar with that term. He's not known for it. I've had the good fortune of working with some academics who kind of came up with that observation and concept and wrote about some of these people and both the trials and tribulations as well as the successes that they've had.
COVID-19 patients need your help.
If you've fully recovered from COVID-19
or unknowingly been exposed to it,
you may have the antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients recover.
Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies.
Visit Vitalant.org today to schedule an appointment to donate blood.
That's Vitalant.org. Help save lives and schedule your appointment at Vitalant.org.
You could help save lives.
I feel like with a podcast that's called the Innovation Podcast, it feels like, Mark, we maybe should have done a moment of silence at the beginning of this podcast or
definitely.
Something with the recent passing of Clayton Christensen. I'm trying to think. I'm pretty sure I read Innovator's Dilemma in more than one class in MBA, and then multiple times like post-MBA in like my actual career have had cause to go back to it. Or invoke, you know, language or paraphrase it or what have you. What an amazing thinker. And you had some contact with him, right?
I did not speak with him directly, but I worked with a number of his colleagues. And in particular, I was able to witness the impact he had on executives in the world and the change in strategic mindset that executives adopted once they started getting a grasp on that theory of disruptive innovation.
So how many times a day do we use that phrase? I mean, either disruption or disruptive innovation. I mean, you know, I'm trying to recall how old that's a 1997 book, I think, right?
And right.
So that was right at the oh my goodness, right. So that was right when I was coming out of MBA, and disruption has been top of mind. You know, it's been like a major prism through which investors and entrepreneurs look at their world since the late 90s. And I'm guessing he probably was writing it several years before that. So, let's just call it the mid 90s, right?
Absolutely.
Right? 20 plus years at this point, and it's still super topical.
Exactly.
That's impressive.
The thing I find interesting is when he came out with his theory of disruption, he's got a very narrow definition of what it means. It was a very particular way that products and services would come up from a lower level. You know, people who are just trying to make something a little more accessible or a little more affordable for a low-end customer. And then the quality would get better and better and better and eventually overtake these incumbents. And that is not what I think most people think of when they think the word disruption. Honestly, right. I think most people think like disruption is I got my butt handed to me in the marketplace by an upstart competitor and I didn't react very well. It's kind of used as an excuse for strategic blindness more than anything. But it's still the impact that it had even come out with this theory and show how incumbents, especially in that innovator's dilemma, incumbents who are making basically the right decisions based on everything they've been taught are working themselves out of a job because they're not paying enough attention to this. And the impact that I see with that nowadays is that executives are more paranoid, to put it bluntly. They're out thinking that, somebody out there, some small player that I used to dismiss as a nobody, could in fact be the one that puts me out of a job. And that is changing the way they think. And it's changing some of the strategic decisions that they're making.
All of that is generally for the good. If you take a step back and you kind of take a very macro analysis of that narrow definition of disruption versus something like the concept of the black swan, the thing that's making executives nervous is not actually that people are out there methodically pursuing Clayton Christensen's doctrines of disruption. What they're really afraid of, in my humble opinion, is actually more of a black swan concept. But whatever, that's probably debatable on multiple levels. But there's no getting around like how impactful Clayton Christensen's doctrines and beliefs have been. I feel like there was some part of this change around entrepreneurship and innovation being a lifestyle. People like myself and, you know, I think you two are both whippersnappers. You're too young to remember this. But when I was becoming, that was a joke. when I was starting out, entrepreneurship was like, you know, the black sheep in the family. It was, you know, parents wanted their kids to be bankers, doctors, and lawyers, right. not entrepreneurs. And since the late 90s or roughly the mid 90s, from then until now, it's become this seminal shift and it's become more of a lifestyle and an aspirational lifestyle, one that people really aspire to. I'm convinced that the notion of disruption went hand in hand with that sort of sociocultural shift of entrepreneurship being like, you know, a default mode versus an aspirational lifestyle.
That's a very good insight. And the stress that executives now put on not only innovating themselves, but ensuring that they're not disrupted, that's the mind shift that I see when it comes to their strategic thinking. And a perfect example of that would come from my work with the Good Food Institute. And I got to see, well, I should say the Good Food Institute is a nonprofit that is working to support the industries of plant-based and cell-cultivated meat, egg, and dairy products. Mm-hmm. And the Beyond Burger, the Possible Whopper that you see at Burger King, the Beyond Sausage at Dunkin' Donuts, those are the types of products that are hitting the marketplace now. And I think if you were doing this same thing 20 years ago, a lot of the meat companies would just be dismissing those as, yeah, it's, you know, it's some other product. That's not real meat. You know, we're not going to pay attention to them. But instead, and I think a lot of this has to do with Christensen's influence, you see companies like Tyson and Smithfield in the U.S., JBS in Brazil, Maple Leaf Foods in Canada, PHW in Germany. They're all investing in these plant-based products, in the cell-cultivated products of the future, and they're doing it with disruption on their lips. They're always saying, like, we don't want to be the next Kodak. We don't want to be the Kodak of the meat industry. We want to be embracing these things and helping them along because we see it as the future, as opposed to just ignoring it and hoping it goes away.
Yeah, no, GFI, Good Food Institute, is doing wonderful work, and that is where you and I met, I think, right? It was while you were an executive there, and I think you were doing some pretty, it's going to sound trite, but fairly innovative things in terms of, but if I'm remembering correctly, you created a some sort of infrastructure or maybe a programmatic platform, I don't know how you would describe it, that would connect up their advocacy, right, to actual entrepreneurs in the field doing actual entrepreneurial innovative stuff. That's
exactly what we're doing. And I can't take credit for creating it. It was definitely a team effort across the board. But I think the concept that GFI has as a nonprofit is a very intriguing innovation in itself, where most nonprofits, if they have a cause, like their approach is going to be, we're going to either scream and shout or rely on education to change the world. And GFI came at it and said, you know what, the screaming and shouting and the education doesn't actually work. What works is helping people create products and services that consumers just naturally want. They don't have to change their behavior. They can just adopt a new product that fits their lifestyle already. And that's where the support for these types of products and the companies that are creating them came from. I think that's a fabulous insight right there, that telling people to do something different or even educating them why they should do something different doesn't actually drive change. And in making it easy for people to adopt a new behavior is far better way to create the change you want in the world. I'm reminded of there's a great cartoon where there's a guy on a platform and he says, who wants change? And the whole crowd's going, yeah, we want change. And then he says, who wants to change? Dead silence. And that's really the way we tend to view the world. You know, we all want things to change, but we want other people to have to do it. We don't want to have to do it ourselves. So that was the cool insight that GFI had. I really think that with the kind of success they're having with these industries, I think it could be a model for the future for a lot of different nonprofits to take a very different approach to how they drive change in the world.
All right, next time, Brad is back for the second of three parts, and we talk about some misconceptions around innovation. So stay tuned.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit theinnovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.